is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network. The News for the Soul Radio Network airs daily, and our archives are always totally free. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.
It's time now for Planning on Purpose with Stacy Walters. Stacy, an estate planning lawyer based in North Carolina, lives to help others. In 2008, her five-month-old daughter, Shayla's heart stopped unexpectedly, causing brain damage that left her severely disabled. This served as a calling for Stacy that renewed her spirit of serving others by focusing her law practice on protecting and preparing families for unexpected life events and end-of-life issues. Let's take one step closer to peace of mind. Here's Stacy now.
Hi there. Well, welcome to Planning on Purpose. I am attorney Stacy Walters, a North Carolina licensed estate planning attorney, and I'm going to be your legal guide today. Today, we're going to talk about who's the boss. Who is in control when you're not? Oh, gosh, we all hate to think about that idea. We have to give up control. Well, sometimes, most of the time, it happens completely unexpectedly, whether we wanted it to or not. You know, back in the 80s, there was a TV show called Who's the Boss? It actually ran for about 8 seasons. It was a pretty popular show. It was about a widower named Tony. He was a former Major League Baseball player, and he was forced to retire due to a shoulder injury. Well, he wanted to get out of Brooklyn, provide a little bit better environment for his daughter, who he was raising on his own after his wife passed away. And he landed a job in a pretty upscale area of Fairfield, Connecticut, was a live-in housekeeper. And he was working for a divorced advertising executive named Angela Bauer. She also had a son, a little younger than his daughter. And the whole plot revolves around the role reversal of the two lead characters, you know, where in this case the woman is the breadwinner and the man who's not her husband stays at home and takes care of the household and cooks and cleans and all that good stuff. It was actually quite fun to watch when I was younger. So what does that have to do with what we're up to today? Well, let me tell you. You need to be planning on who's going to be the boss if you cannot do it and maintain control yourself. We're going to walk through a lot of our life events today, of course, stories as always, to take a look at, number one, what scenarios could we end up with somebody else being the boss and in control? Number two, how do we make really good decisions about who we would want to be in control of various things so that if the unexpected has happened and we aren't in control, we have planned ahead of time so we know who the boss is. So let's get started. You know, minor children cannot be the boss. As much as they try, they absolutely cannot legally be the boss. Now, typically, it's going to be their biological parents. Sometimes kids are adopted, and lawfully, the adoptive parents are the ones who are in control. You may find that there are minors who have gone into a foster care system. They have guardians, legal guardians, and the guardians are the ones who are in control. But what happens if something happens to the parents or the guardian? This is the important part. If you have not planned and made provisions for who would step up, who would be able to care for the children, then it's going to be a court proceeding called a guardianship. And we're going to get into that in just a few minutes. But let's talk about how then do we plan? I mean, I never know if something's going to happen to me, and I have a 15-year-old son. My husband and I do go out, so we could be in the same car accident together, and we both perish. So you really, especially when you have, you're starting a family or you have young children, you really want to make sure to get an appointment of a guardianship in place. there's a lot of different ways here in North Carolina that you can do that. My favorite way, though, is always to do it as a freestanding legal document. Here's why. A lot of people will put the guardianship appointment in their last will and testament. And a last will and testament never takes effect until after you are gone. Well, what if you are incapacitated? Let's just put you in a coma. And you obviously can't, child, you can't do the parent thing. So we may not be gone. And going through that, the will in order to find the guardianship is a little bit more cumbersome. So we do separate guardianship appointment papers here. And I'm a huge fan of always having a backup plan. So while you might appoint one person to be the guardian, maybe something happens and they can't. Or maybe they don't qualify through the court process. So you always want to have a second backup named as well. You know, the worst thing that can happen is no one is appointed at the time that something happens to you, and then there's a tug of war. One of the things that I saw when I first got out of law school, I was clerking with a judge up in Michigan, was that exact thing, was the tug of war. You got the two sides of the grandparents coming in, and the dad is housed in jail, and the mom died in a car accident. And they're fighting over who's going to be the guardian because there were no clear directions from the mom who passed away. And the dad being in jail can't be the guardian. And on top of that, he can't have a voice in it because of the hearing process. So, place for a child to be. It's not about you, and it's not about your either ex-spouse or current spouse or the grandparents. It's about that child and making sure that whomever you decide that you would want to be the guardian would hopefully, you know, follow the same type of moral upbringing and teaching. And those are things that you need to think about. So when you're looking at a guardian for your minor children, above all, I would want to make sure that they would love my kids, probably not as their own, but, you know, I wouldn't want to put them with somebody who I've been around and they always yell at their kids. I want it to be a positive environment. I want to, of course, talk to that person and make sure that they are okay with, if something happens to me, that they could pick up and serve as the guardian. Sometimes you want to align maybe religious beliefs. Sometimes maybe you want somebody who lives in the same area so your child doesn't have to move. Sometimes you would prefer maybe one particular family member over another one. It's super important to make sure, though, that you're comfortable and the potential guardian is comfortable. And so you need to have some really good conversations about that. Now, the thing is that if you have not appointed a guardian and something tragic happens, the child can become what's called a ward of the state. In other words, social services comes in and they take the kid, place it in foster care. It's away from your family while the fighting's going on until the judge can sort everything out and figure out who would be the best person to serve as the guardian for your minor child. Can you imagine how frightening that would be? I have a college roommate who worked in Child Protective Services, go into the home and look at the setting and if neglect, abuse, endangerment, and she was taking the kids out of the home. I can't imagine how scared they were, but then imagine all of a sudden the parent that you've been with, the guardian that you've been with, they're not able to care for you, and now you're thrust in a different direction. So you've got two things coming at you. So it's super important at least to try to consider what would be best for your child without leaving it up to the state. People often ask me, well, Stacy, can my power of attorney appoint a guardian? No, not for your children. When you have a power of attorney, there might be a guardianship provision in there, but it's allowing that power of attorney called your agent to serve as your guardian if something should happen to you, but you're alive. So powers of attorney won't help us, and we've got to make sure that we're planning for that guardianship. Now, when our kids turn age 18, guess who's in charge? They are. Doesn't matter if they live at home. Doesn't matter if they're in college and you're paying all the bills. They turn age 18 and lawfully here in North Carolina. They are a legal adult, and we really lose control at that point. Not a bad thing. I mean, I really want my kid to have independence when he turns age 18. However, I do absolutely want to make sure that if anything happens to him, let's say he's texting and driving and he runs off the road and flips the car and now he's in ICU, I definitely want to be the one in control. I want to know that if anything happens to my kid before he has, you know, someone else like a spouse to rely upon for those kinds of decisions, that I am the one that's in control. Parents are really surprised when their kids go off to college and their kid calls and they're sick and they said they went to the infirmary and they've been taking medicine, but they're not getting any better. The parent calls the infirmary, the doctor won't talk to them, the nurse won't talk to them. Why? Well, because they aren't the guardian anymore. The only way that the infirmary would talk to the parent is if, number one, there's a HIPAA release. Remember, your HIPAA release covers the federal privacy acts that deal with our health information. That release should be executed when your kid turns age 18, and it allows you to get information from the doctors, from the hospital, about their health. You also need to have a health care power of attorney. Without that health care power of attorney, if something tragic were to happen, you cannot make those medical care decisions. Our doctors take what's called a Hippocratic Oath, and they have full authority to do everything that they can to keep us alive. If your child were on life support and you weren't able to make that decision, you felt very strongly that that's not the way that they would want to remain here on earth, then you might have an uphill battle that could evolve into a court battle. So you really do want to make sure that even when our kids turn age 18, you're being proactive and you're helping them get their powers of attorney, HIPAA release in place, so you can still play an active role in their life, come what may. And it's always going to be the unexpected. Now, I want to fast forward to a little different scenario, one that I think most parents and guardians would not have contemplated. We're going to call him Uncle Steve. Uncle Steve, my Uncle Steve, he was married, got a divorce, and he was the care provider for his two daughters, biological daughters. The mom had addictions, and she was not on the scene, didn't come to visit, didn't call, had no relationship with her children. And Uncle Steve suffered a medical malpractice injury that left him completely disabled. And so Uncle Steve was taken in by one of her nieces, his nieces, and she helped care for his two girls. I think they were around ages 4 and 8, something like that. Unfortunately, Uncle Steve didn't live as long as they were hoping he would, and he passed away probably when the youngest was about 7, so he lived about 3 years or so. And all this time, you know, the daughters have been living there with his other niece. She's been raising them. She has a daughter of her own. They're about the same age. And all of a sudden, after he passes away, we're probating the will, and it does have a guardianship in there. It appoints his niece to be the guardian. Well, there was one big problem. The other parent, the other biological parent, still still alive. And that means that lawfully the court couldn't appoint a guardian. Why? Well, because our biological parents are our guardians. Unless something has occurred to terminate the parental rights of a parent, the court can't just override that. They have to determine that the parent's unfit or that the parent has abandoned the child, that sort of thing. So we actually ended up having to go through a termination of parental rights proceeding in order to dissolve that legal relationship that the mom who's still alive has with the daughters in order to award the guardianship to his niece who's been raising these girls for many years now. So that's another thing to contemplate is, you know, just because you have a parent who is missing in action on the scene, they're in jail, they're estranged because they remarried, what have you, doesn't mean that who you are going to appoint is going to be appointed right away. So that might be something else that you would want to work out ahead of time, because divorce doesn't terminate the parental rights, only the state, or in this case, if the estranged mom would have signed a termination of parental rights where she agreed to terminate her parental rights, then we would have been able to move forward, but we couldn't even figure out exactly where she was. Anyway, to a couple of more things when we're talking about who's the boss. And we're going to jump into adulthood now, and we're going to focus a little bit more on husband and wife for a little bit. So when we're married, we often think, well, if something happened to my spouse, you know, I'll be able to do everything I need to do and take care of that spouse and that good stuff. Well, that definitely is not the case. So a few years ago, I had someone who had an appointment set up. They're just going to come in and talk to me about estate planning. And just a few days before the appointment, the wife called and canceled, and the husband said they didn't need to do anything. They weren't ready. And I got a call about 3 weeks later, and she said, 2 days after we were supposed to come in, my husband was up changing the light bulb, and he fell off the ladder. He fell all the way down the stairs, suffered a brain bleed, and now he is incompetent and in the hospital. She said, I can't make any decisions. I don't have any type of health care power of attorney. I don't have a financial power of attorney. I mean, I can't find out how much money is in his checking account. I can't write the checks to pay the bills. What do I do? Now, that puts us back into a guardianship. And let me tell you, she showed me video. I'd already met with them casually at a public speaking event, and I just clearly remember them. And she showed me a video of him, and I could not believe his medical state. It was just in a flash, completely changed unexpectedly. And so for her, it meant that she was going to have to go through a guardianship. Now, here was the interesting thing. They had a blended family. I don't recall if she had any children, but I remember he had a son and I believe a daughter. And the son was wanting to fight for guardianship of dad. They didn't want his wife, who's the stepmom, to be the one pursuing the guardianship. And that's one of the hardest things about when we haven't planned and prepared. Other people might have ideas in their head about who should be the boss and who should be in charge, who should be in control and making those decisions. And when they don't disagree, so when the son, the stepson and the wife didn't see eye to eye, well, now the court gets to decide, and there's going to be a battle, and the court's going to try to determine who's fit and maybe more fit, more able, more capable of being able to serve as the guardian. that's definitely not somewhere I would want to place my spouse if something tragic like that happened. I can only imagine the stress that she was under seeing how quickly this evolved into him being completely incapacitated, unable to stand up on his own, unable to talk, unable to feed himself. So how do we plan ahead then? Well, as adults, we've already talked about our kids when they turn age 18. We too need to have these healthcare power of attorneys. And you always have to look at it that it's not a one and done deal. When you're planning, don't plan with just one person. I want at least two. So if the first one can't do it, the second one can. Maybe you don't want just one person. You want a bunch of people. You want them to all act together. Sometimes that happens, particularly with regards to healthcare, because they don't want to put what they perceive as a burden for somebody to make decisions on just one person. Or maybe let's say I have three kids and I don't want, you know, there to be a squabble. I want all three of them to have a voice. No matter what the decisions are, whether it's, you know, what rehab I'm going to, or if they nicked my spleen, are we going to try to repair it or take it out? And of course, end of life decisions, it always varies. When you're looking at who is in charge, particularly as a family, all about keeping the peace. Now, on the healthcare side of things, they do not have to live close. Healthcare, you don't have to go face-to-face into the hospital. They can do it by teleconference, of course, now, phone conference, and it's not necessary for you to be physically in the area with whomever it is that you're serving as their healthcare power of attorney. What is important, though, is that whomever you are appointing to make healthcare decisions for you is, number one, willing. Some people don't want that responsibility. Number two, you should consider what would make them a good healthcare advocate. Advocate. They are going to stand up for you. They are going to hopefully fight for you. They are going to be the one making decisions for you. Now, I have met a woman. And she likes her daughter a lot, even though they don't necessarily see eye to eye. But daughter married a gentleman who ascribes to different beliefs than my client. And he has a lot of influence over her. And she said, I absolutely do not want her making any healthcare decisions for me because I know what his beliefs are, and she's following suit, and I'm really concerned that they're going to do things that I wouldn't want done. So brilliant of her to have that insight, and that's what you all need to think about, too, when you're planning on who's going to be the boss if you're not able. So if you're not able to make your own healthcare decisions, would you want somebody, for example, that ascribes to electroshock therapy? How would you feel if your healthcare agent gave permission for a blood transfusion? What if there was an experimental vaccine and they wanted to try that? Would you feel comfortable with that? And so sharing information, of course, along the way is important, but more importantly, is trying to make sure that your feelings about healthcare can be quantified and expressed to your healthcare agent and that they would follow it. And often that happens because they have the same type of philosophies and ascribe to the same feelings and beliefs as we do. Now, aside from healthcare, so as adults, you've already learned that if you don't have a healthcare power of attorney, then we're strapped. We're not able to find out medical information if we don't have a hip release. That's true of a husband and a wife. You can call the doctor's office and say, did my wife make it over there for a 10 o'clock appointment? And they cannot answer that question under the HIPAA laws. However, end-of-life decisions are totally different. North Carolina, like a lot of states, they have done away with what is called a DNR, do not resuscitate, so that we ourselves cannot issue our own do not resuscitate orders. Now, if we're on hospice, there's automatically a do not resuscitate order that comes into play. Whether we like it or not, hospice means it's palliative care, and they are just making us comfortable as we reach the end of our life. However, outside of that scenario, we can tattoo on our chest DNR, and it wouldn't make a difference. So you have to have a doctor's order. And in North Carolina, that goes by way of something called a MOST form, M-O-S-T. A lot of states follow them. It might be called GAST or some other acronym, MAST, M-A-S-T. But North Carolina, the MOST form is a medical order subscribing treatment. And it's something that you go over with your doctor at a time where you feel like it's important to have this conversation. I know I had a wonderful lady in my life. She was in her late 50s, stage 4 lung cancer, and they told her they had done everything that they could do. They were at the end, and it was just really a matter of time. She gave me a copy of the MOST form, and it said, if you find me not breathing, if my heart isn't beating, do not resuscitate me. She said, you know, one of my biggest fears isn't dying of cancer. I'm afraid that I'll have a car accident. I'll be dead from the car accident, and they're going to bring me back, and then I have to continue to suffer through the end stages of this cancer. Wow, really insightful. I hadn't thought about that. And so she told me, she says, so I've taped this MOST form. A copy won't work, so my doctor gave me 3 or 4 or 5. One's taped to my front door in case EMS shows up. I don't want them to resuscitate me. One's taped to the roof, inside roof of my vehicle. You have one, and then my son has one. So that, you know, who is in control and who is the boss? We can't be in control of a do not resuscitate during our lifetime in North Carolina. It's got to be that MOST form where the doctor orders based on our conversation, based on whatever, you know, is going on, where the doctor is comfortable with issuing an order. And that's who determines that DNR. Now, aside from a do not resuscitate, we do have control over our end-of-life decisions in terms of life support. So while we are alive, we are legally able to dictate to the doctors and dictate to our healthcare power of attorney what we want. But we have to do it while we're competent, while we're able to make decisions. In North Carolina, it's called an advanced directive for a natural death. It's a living will. And that legal directive has really evolved over the years. Now, your healthcare power of attorney already has authority to make end-of-life decisions for you if you need life support, but I find in my practice that a lot of people have very strong feelings about if they need life support and the doctors have tested and determined whatever the cause is that is forcing them to need life support, it's not reversible. They have in their own mind exactly what they want. I'll tell you, the younger our clients are, the harder it is for them to think about that because, you know, we all think we're going to live forever anyway. But it is important for not only you to be able to express your wishes in writing, but it's also equally important for your family to see this. As always, the unexpected happened, and lovely lady's husband suffered a stroke, and it left him completely unconscious. He couldn't swallow, couldn't breathe on his own. And she said, we never talked about it. It was the worst thing to have to make that decision. And the guilt that she held, I mean, not only is she in shock because all of a sudden her husband's right there with her and now he is laying in a bed on life support, but she had no idea what he would want. And she convinced herself, and probably rightfully so, you know, he is a very vibrant, outgoing individual. Is this really the way he would want to be? So she waited 2-3 days more, made sure there wasn't any more evidence that he may pull out of this, you know, miraculously before she made that decision, but it really weighed heavy on her heart. She did have health care power of attorney, but he didn't have a living will. And after talking with the doctors, she did decide to let him go and take him off life support. Now, if he would have had a living will, here's how it would have worked. If he were in that situation, he's unconscious. He has a condition that is not reversible and he needs life support. Then his first choice here in North Carolina is to leave it to the doctors. Let them decide. Or he can tell the doctors, nope, no way, no how. I don't want to be here like this. And on that living will paper, he can tell the doctors, if you find me like that, you shall withhold life support. You don't have a say-so, doctor. But it's the only opportunity that we have is to do this beforehand via a living will. The second part of this is to be able to dictate if we're, you know, on life support and we're being let go, do we still want things like artificial nutrition, artificial hydration? But aside from all that, if you told the doctor, let me go in this living will, if you have left it up to the doctor and the doctor decides they want to take out life support, there's still an opportunity for your health care power of attorney to act if you allow it. Some people don't want their health care power of attorney to be in that position. They feel like it is an emotional burden. It's going to be too much stress. Some people, though, feel very, what's the right word, comforted, knowing that if they were on life support and their loved one saw anything for any reason, that they could say, nope, leave them on life support, and then ultimately make that final decision. It varies. But these living wills, you know, when we talk about the doctors, we can craft these and ascribe them a little different with our healthcare now. But if you had a particular physician that you wanted to make that decision, then that's who we're going to put. Versus you're in the hospital and the hospitalist is making that decision who is in charge of your medical case at the time. We all know doctors are well-educated, but definitely medicine is a science. For those of you who do have family physicians, you want to have their input, then make sure that you get that living will done. Don't leave that responsibility solely on your healthcare power of attorney. I'll tell you, though, there are some people who say, nope, no way, no how. I do not want to think about that. I'm going to let my healthcare power of attorney decide. And that's fine, too, as long as you have a health care power of attorney that's able to do that. All right, where are we at? So, who's the boss? We've talked about our health care power of attorney, our living will. Now let's talk about our financial power of attorney. I don't know if you all have ever really read what's called a durable power of attorney. Ours in North Carolina, I really tailor them because every time I have a family or hear of a story where someone has ran into trouble, it wasn't specifically spelled out in the power of attorney, I add it to our power of attorney. So our power of attorney is pretty lengthy. We ascribe in North Carolina to the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, and I just add to it. So, for example, I know in 2015, I bet I made 2-3 changes that particular year to our power of attorney. One of the changes was the banks were refusing to let whoever had the power of attorney pull principal out of an IRA. And unless it said it specifically, even though it said they could do any and all banking transactions, take cash out of accounts, didn't matter. They wanted to see it there specifically.
So I changed it to make sure it was in there.
However, that power of attorney, that durable power of attorney, can let that agent that you appoint do every single thing that you can do. Everything. Buy a car, sell a house, cash out the IRA, sign a lease, enter into a contract, sign your tax returns, give away assets, add to a trust. I mean, just everything that you can do, they can do. I love it that way, though, because let me tell you, when the unexpected happens, it is miserable for a loved one or a family to not be able to do what they need to do in order to either help you or to continue to take care of the family at the time. So the broader, the more detailed, the better, as far as I'm concerned. It's really difficult to sit with those families and say, I'm sorry, but I can't do what you're asking me to do because you don't have the authority and the power of attorney. And at the point that they realize it, it's when their loved one has become incapacitated and they're not able to help them. The only way they can help them is if they go through a guardianship, and so that puts us back in court. By the way, those guardianships are not very quick. They usually take us 2 to 4 months to get through. Part of them, though, is the fact that your loved one is tied to the court. They have to report to the court after 90 days what the assets are, that sort of thing. Now, when we talk about the durable power of attorney, proximity is important. It's not entirely, forbidden if somebody's out of state. It just means it's going to be a little bigger burden on that individual. So imagine this. You have a power of attorney. You need to get on their checking account so you can write checks. Well, the bank wants to see you face-to-face. They don't believe that you have a power of attorney. They want to see your license. They're going to run that power of attorney through their legal department. The legal department is going to make sure, of course, that it's valid under the current laws, that it was properly executed, and that it gives you the authority to do what you're trying to do through the bank. That's not a quick process either. But I do often encourage my clients for their power of attorney to try to consider and pick somebody who is in the area. You also want to make sure, above all, with that power of attorney, it's somebody you trust. It doesn't matter to me how old they are. It doesn't matter to me what their skill set is. They don't need to be a CPA or an accountant. But you do want to make sure that you trust them. Now, I just said it doesn't matter how old they are, but it does. They do have to be over age 18. But if let's say it's your sister and they're older than you, as long as she's competent and you trust her, it doesn't matter to me. But that's why we always say, you know, estate planning is not a one-and-done deal. You have to make sure that you look at your estate planning documents periodically. I always say once a year. April the 15th is the date that I tell all my clients. We all know that date, and we don't ever have hot holiday plans going on. So it's a perfect opportunity to pick up your estate planning documents and just look at it to make sure life hasn't changed. Like your sister passed away, but you forgot you have her named as the health care power of attorney. Or maybe your husband was diagnosed with dementia, and oh my gosh, he's my current power of attorney. And what if he went to the bank and took everything out of my savings account? So you need to make sure to take a look at those periodically. Also, when you're talking about a durable power of attorney, sometimes people want to check in a balance. They often will consider two children as co-agents. There is a risk, and I have seen it come to fruition, not necessarily from the children. Well, I've seen that before. But there is a risk that if you have a single power of attorney, they run off with all the money or they start spending it inappropriately and it's not on you. And once it's gone, it's really hard to recoup it. You know, we had to turn this case away for a conflict, but There was a gentleman who had dementia, and he had three kids. One of the daughters was the power of attorney, and the other two kids started figuring out that The money was disappearing. He had had like $20,000 in the checking account. Now there was nothing there, or she had closed the account and opened it in her name, just all sorts of things. And while I'm sure he trusted her, the problem was now she still had full authority, and they were going to have to go battle for a breach of her fiduciary duties and then sue to get guardianship because he didn't name a backup. That's not the position I would want to be in if I were, you know, the dad. I've also seen it where clients come to me and they have seen it happen within their own family. They have a caregiver, for example, and the caregiver has some influence, and Uncle, you know, Mark signs a power of attorney and gives the caregiver power of attorney, and the next thing you know, he's saying, oh, well, you know, why don't you buy yourself a new outfit, and why don't you do this, and why don't you do that? And so when you have at least two agents, then, and you tie them together, then that's a good check and balance if you're concerned. Otherwise, I am a huge proponent of having more than two agents or two or more agents. They're called co-agents, but I like to make it so they can act together or solely. So, for example, a lot of times our families have children who aren't close by, and they don't want the children to be upset because we named this one and not the other one. I'm like, well, why don't we just name all three of them? And they can act together or solely, so they can divide and conquer. So if one has time to call up the realtor, even though they're living in California and your house is here in North Carolina, then get the contract going. The other one, they can start writing the checks because they live right beside of you and make sure the lawn is taken care of and the house is getting ready and cleaned for sale, that sort of thing. All right, let's see. Try not to worry about people's feelings when you are appointing people who you want to be in charge. As long as you have confidence in them, then you don't want to appoint somebody just because you're worried about offending them. Nothing other than disaster is likely to result from that, especially if there's already been, I'm going to call it a little pressure for you to name that individual. That definitely is a recipe for things to go awry. When you're considering your successor or alternate agents, so if your initial ones can't serve, you certainly might want to look at things like if they have a diagnosis, maybe they're in the military and they travel around a lot. Maybe one is a stay-at-home mom of five kids, and she has her plate so full, it would be very difficult for her to serve as power of attorney. So these are all things that you should consider when you're looking at certainly a financial power of attorney. And then healthcare, of course, plays in differently in terms of, we've already talked about the proximity. By the way, your healthcare power of attorney doesn't have to know medicine. I mean, a lot of times I do have clients who will choose a niece or a nephew or a brother or sister or an in-law because they are in the medical field and they feel like that they would take that burden off their family, and it is somebody that they trust and they think that their perspective is going to be really different. By the way, I do want to put this in there. There are nonprofit organizations that can serve as healthcare and financial or durable power of attorney. You know, there's a pretty big percentage of the baby boomer population who does not have any children. They're older. They have very few family members left above them. Maybe they were an only child as well. And so sometimes those individuals go, well, I don't have anybody. A good lawyer knows how to sit down with you and brainstorm to help you find what's comfortable that you feel absolutely good about in terms of a plan for who's going to be that boss if you cannot be in control. All right, we're on the home stretch here. The next who's the boss? So we made it through our life. We've gotten all of our agents in place. And now we're gone. Then what happens? Who's in charge?
You know, it always amazes me how many people procrastinate, don't want to deal with end of life, and they pass away, they don't have a will. I mean, just that basic part of estate planning, it seems like a complete no-brainer in so many ways. It doesn't make it any easier, really, if you have a will in terms of the process afterwards, but what does happen if you don't have a will? You haven't appointed somebody the executor. Or, worse yet, what happens if you do have a will and the person you've appointed can't qualify to serve as the executor? You know, North Carolina, like most states, we all have laws that say, listen, the executor or the administrator of the state, if you don't have a will, they're called an administrator, they have a high fiduciary duty. That means they are on a higher level of trust because the court's going to give them authority to take your assets out of your name and then distribute them in accordance with the terms of the trust along with paying off your bills. So, for example, if your executor that you've named is a felon, they cannot serve. No one under 18 can serve. If you don't name somebody, well, the court has a plan for you. I can guarantee you that. Not only that, but your creditors, they have a plan too. When we are gone, creditors need to be paid. They don't sit idly by and just wait for somebody to open the estate. They'll start pushing through at the appropriate time, a few months after you're gone, to give, you know, somebody else an opportunity to step up. And the question is, well, gosh, who would be in charge? Well, it could be just the attorney who they're called the public administrator that's there in the county, and they're going to be in charge. It could be your estranged daughter who you absolutely would never want to be in charge. You haven't seen her, you know, in 30 years. Could be your niece, you know, relatives really play a stronghold here. But the point is if we don't name somebody, state will take care of it if a probate is necessary. Now, who do we name? Who do we look to name as executors? I get asked this question quite a bit. And in the executor realm, again, somebody that you trust, absolutely here in North Carolina, it should be somebody that is relatively close. Why? Because that executor has to go back and forth to the court to get the things filed, to open the estate account, to drop the ad off of the newspaper and pay the fees, to run the ad to the notice to creditors for 4 weeks in the paper, to file the inventory, to meet the estate auction company to sell the stuff out of the house, to sign the closing papers, you know, when the house sells, to go down to the DMV to transfer the vehicle title. There's a lot of work that executor has to do. And so them being in state close by makes it easier than somebody who is in state and isn't close by. On top of that, if the person that you've named as executor is out of state, well, they've got some additional hoops to jump. And one of those hoops is they are going to have to name somebody local as an agent. So if the court has to serve papers or somebody in North Carolina that they can serve them on. And then number two is they're going to have to post a bond. So that out-of-state executor has to post a bond and is based on initially the approximated size of the estate that's going through the court probate process. So in other words, what's the value of all your assets? Do you need to have an attorney? Do you need to have somebody who is not, you know, who is the brightest bulb in the box, if you will? Well, the answer is no, but you do need somebody who has the time, who physically is able to go back and forth to the courthouse, and who can follow instructions from the lawyer. Yeah. We always talk in North Carolina about probate. Every state is different. Don't get me wrong. Every state is different. But in North Carolina, the clerk of court is the judge over the probate division, which means they cannot give legal advice. And so when your poor brother, who's 68 years old, and he owned a lawn care company all of his life. He gets down there, smart guy, businessman. He doesn't know how to fill these forms out because they're legal forms. The court won't help him. It cannot give legal advice because they're the judge over the division. So most of the time, those executors do hire us lawyers to help walk them through that legal process, do the paperwork, but then they do the legwork. All right, one last, who's in control? In terms of funeral arrangements, did you know most states require legal hoops to be jumped before you can proceed with a funeral or cremation? So one of the things that we do, particularly as it relates to cremation, is we jump that legal hoop with our clients. Again, it is very helpful to have somebody who is in state closer by, but it simply appoints someone to be able to say, look, here, mom signed the cremation form. She wanted to be cremated. She put me in charge, so we don't have to look at the laws about who all you have to call and wait while mom's body is in limbo. You can go ahead and cremate her. And that's what happens if you haven't jumped these legal hoops and put somebody appointed already in charge of this. Excuse me. To me, it's really ideal if you have prepaid services. I mean, your wishes are all spelled out. Everything is taken care of. You've done it. You've named the funeral home, the director, all that good stuff. Forgive me for coughing. I really am fine. But the pollen is flying like crazy today. So the final planning aspect is another big one. You know, there is one other area I probably should talk about real briefly. Same minus one thing as an executor when you're considering who should be the boss, and that is a trustee over a trust. Whether it's your grandchildren's trust after you're gone, whether it's your revocable living trust and you're incapacitated while you're alive, whether it's your kids' inheritance trust, whatever it is, the trustee has a lot of responsibility. And, of course, number one is to make sure that you trust them. But number two is they can be really anywhere. They don't have to be right here in the state with you. They honestly don't have to be right here in the United States with you. Because trusts are portable, they cross state lines because we're a very electronic society, because you have appointed already somebody in a living trust to be in charge, there's not all of those legal hoops like an executor has to jump. And remember, trust avoids the court probate process. So there's no running back and forth to the court. There's nothing in a trust that's ever recorded with the courthouse. So the key to a trustee who's in charge when you're gone, who is in control if you're incapacitated, is number one, you got to trust them. My number two is I really like to have somebody who's going to do it for free. They care about you. They love your family. They want to meet your goals. It's not nearly as burdensome. It's so simple and easy when we have a revocable living trust. And so lawyers, banks, financial advising institutions, trust companies, they aren't the top ones that you might consider. Some people, however, though, go, you know what, I would much rather have somebody else outside my family do it because it'll keep the peace. Perfect insight. I would much rather have somebody else outside the family do it because my kids are too busy. One travels, one's overseas. Or I'd much rather have somebody outside the family do it because I want to make sure my grandkids get this money and my son-in-law is a spendthrift and I just know his influence over my daughter and she's going to end up spending that money and it's not going to be there for my grandkids. He's going to make her take it out and buy a boat for him or something. So at the end of the day, who is the boss? Always has a plan for you if you don't have a plan. It's never going to be who you want to be. At Thomas Walter's Estate Planning and Probate, we're a multi-state company.
We have offices across the 5 states. We hold licenses in about 10 or 12 states. This is all we do. Every day I sit and I talk with people. I love doing estate planning because I see the rewards of when we plan, how much easier it is. I want to thank you all for letting me be your legal guide today. Have a fabulous evening and happy estate planning. Until we see you again. Thank you.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.